morning we want to talk about views of war and peace. I think that in a century that which has witnessed the human slaughter of two world wars, has seen the creation and the use of the first atomic bombs, massive destruction of wars like Korea, the war in Vietnam, countless civil wars in Central America and all around the globe as we experience it every day. It's probably an understatement to say that war is the most important ethical issue with which we're called to deal in our time. To make that observation, though, is not to say that war is somehow a new thing. In fact, if we start to look at the various ways in which war has been viewed through the centuries, we would have to say that for most of human history, war has been viewed as a way of life. Simply a way of life. In many cultures, killing people who were not members of your group was simply regarded as another form of hunting. In some pre-literate societies, down almost to the present day, the conviction has survived that killing somebody leads to the acquisition of his soul. One acquires more power, in other words, by killing more people. In most of human history, the heroes of a people were the warriors, and religion supported wars as a natural part of its support for a culture. Since killing was simply the job of the warrior, he ought not to hesitate in doing his duty. The military caste has often been viewed as providing the obvious leadership for a society. Think even today about the countries of Central and South America, and you don't have to do too much imagination to see that there are remnants of this view still around. Enemies or prisoners have not been understood as having any rights, or at least very few rights in this view. This understanding of war has been the most common understanding of war in the course of most of human history. A second view of war, and obviously quite the opposite view, is that of pacifism. Pacifism, of course, as the very word suggests, usually means a refusal to use force or violence, and hence a refusal to participate in war. But what we may need to understand is that pacifism has taken several different forms in history. Ideological pacifists, first of all, are those who object to a war which is carried out under the wrong auspices. For example, a certain kind of socialist living in a capitalist society might assume a pacifist stance, declaring, "I won't fight in a capitalist war." The ideological pacifist is against war if it is sponsored by the wrong people. Jehovah's Witnesses are another example of ideological pacifism. They will fight, but they will fight only in the Battle of Armageddon, where fighting will then be okay. It's just that wars, as they are usually fought in this world, are not the kind of experiences that they will involve themselves with. Absolute pacifists are those who on moral grounds object to all wars, all uses of violence or force. Violence is understood to be simply wrong, and therefore these pacifists won't participate in war at all. Sometimes violence or participation in war is understood to be wrong only for certain groups of people. For example, people with a special vocation, like religious leaders, who ought not to fight in a war. But most often, absolute pacifists consider participation in war simply wrong for everybody, or at least wrong for true believers. A third form of pacifism is pragmatic pacifism. Pragmatic pacifists insist that the renunciation of violence is socially imperative and politically effective. Pacifism is regarded as right, in other words, because it works. Nonviolence is used as an effective instrument for achieving some form of social change. Gandhi or Martin Luther King Jr. were pragmatic pacifists. Nonviolence was used as a kind of effective strategy for making certain things happen. Pragmatic pacifists are always sort of action-oriented people. They desire some kind of change, and pacifism is endorsed as the most effective tool for making that change. Some who suggest unilateral disarmament today, for instance, are pragmatic pacifists. That is, they believe that an armed conflict approach to settling disputes simply is unrealistic, doesn't accomplish what we really want accomplished. And so unilateral disarmament is encouraged as the most effective way of achieving our purposes. A variant of this is sometimes referred to as transmoral pacifism. This is a kind of pacifism that's more often found in Eastern religions like Zen Buddhism, where the question of what's right or wrong is not really the central question at this point. Rather, what's involved is something like what happens in jiu-jitsu, where you step aside and you let the other person destroy himself. The idea is that nothing, if left to itself, will ever get too big. And the attitude is, well, just let it grow and finally it will kill itself. If you don't oppose it, then it will finally strangle itself. You only keep it going by opposing it. A third attitude toward war is that of the holy war. Muslims call it jihad. Christians have a name for it too. We've called it the crusade. Here, war is understood as some kind of a religious reality, and it's fought for a religious objective. World War I was such a holy war, fought to make the world safe for democracy. Eisenhower described his leadership in the Second World War as what? The crusade in Europe. Some forms of liberation theology, which people get very excited about these days, talks about wars of liberation in Central America, and surround those wars again with a kind of holy war mentality. If war is understood as a holy war, then the enemy in such a war is dehumanized. The enemy is then understood to be the tool of Satan or of evil forces. And since the enemy is understood as evil, a holy war requires for its resolution an unconditional surrender. Think about what's going on in Iran today. I mean, they can't possibly surrender, they can't possibly solve that war except with some unconditional surrender, because it's a holy war. In a holy war, the soldier is engaged in a religious task, and he deserves religious rewards. If he's killed in war, he automatically becomes a saint. The truly frightening thing about a crusade or a holy war mentality is that it erodes all prudential and moral restraints on military action. Absolute military victory, accompanied by the unconditional surrender of the enemy, becomes the overriding objective in such a war, because, of course, one cannot compromise with the evil which the enemy represents. Have you sensed any of that in our own understanding of war in the American scene? a fourth attitude toward war, the attitude which has really been the dominant one in the course of Christian thinking on the subject, is that of the just war. The just war theory seeks to set certain parameters within which responsible decisions can be made about war. It tries to provide a set of criteria by which a government or an individual or a society can arrive at a responsible decision in a specific case about war. Now let me back up just a minute and say that in the early church, most of the early Christians were pacifists. Not all of them. We know from some of the writings of the fathers that Christians did also participate in some of the empire's armies, but not very often. Most were pacifists. Not necessarily because of the reasons that I've suggested, sometimes because it involved a form of idolatry, since soldiers had to pledge an oath to the emperor as lord. Most, however, were pacifists for one reason or another. However, when Christianity became the established religion of the empire, and Christians found themselves in positions of authority in the empire, they began to ask other kinds of questions. Then questions evolved like, is it important for me on the basis of Christian love to repel an aggressor for the sake of those for whom I am responsible in my position of leadership? Christian love, in other words, was still at the center of their ethic, but they began to ask some hard questions about their obligations to defend a people and whether that defense also was not a part of Christian love. Well, they set up a kind of list of criteria to justify a particular war. In order for a war to be just, it had to meet these criteria, and I'll summarize them just very briefly. First of all, for a war to be just, they said, it must be declared by a legitimate public authority. You can't have a bunch of private wars going on all over and in any sense regard them as just wars. Only a war that is declared by a legitimate public authority can in any way be just. Secondly, it must be declared in response to a real injury received. Now that would rule out, for instance, a war of aggression. You don't go in as the aggressor someplace, you have to have a real injury. Or rules out wars that are fought on some frivolous pretense or for frivolous reasons. Thirdly, it must be a war that's declared after all reasonable means, peaceful means of settlement have been exhausted. In other words, war isn't something you do first in response to injury, it's something you do last. It's the last kind of resort. Fourthly, they said, those fighting the war must do so with the right attitude. There should be no spirit of vindictiveness, maliciousness, or revenge. Now, that should create some smiles. How do you fight a war without some of those attitudes? The point, however, was that the only way you legitimate the war in the first place is that you say Christian love in this situation requires that you go to war. And that's in opposition to these other motivations of revenge or vindictiveness. Fifthly, they said the damage inflicted must be proportionate to the injury received. This is sometimes referred to as the principle of proportionality. And it means, among other things, that you don't go in and destroy a country in order to save it. Sixthly, they said, a war to be just must be fought with legitimate weapons, legitimate means. Weapons must not be unnecessarily painful or destructive. That's just cruel and barbarous. It's on the basis, actually, of this kind of thinking that we today have the kinds of international accords that we have against biological warfare and poisonous gas and so on. They said a distinction must be maintained between combatants in a war and non-combatants, sometimes called the principle of discrimination, and suggest that while innocent people are obviously always, or nearly always, going to be tragically killed in any war, in the process of attacking, for instance, some legitimate military target, what they meant to say was that the direct killing of innocent people as a primary target is murder, whether it happens inside war or outside of a war. And finally, they said, there must be a reasonable hope of success for it to be a just war. Otherwise, warfare is just merely wanton and futile and pointless destruction of life. There has to be some hope of success if it is going to be regarded as a just war. Now, this just war theory, the dominant thinking about war in the Christian tradition, really stands behind the whole notion of selective conscientious objection. Our attitudes toward participation in war really correspond in some way to how we understand war itself. Let me just suggest very briefly these areas of correspondence. I think there are probably three basic attitudes that a person can take about participating in war. Two of them are Christian possibilities, the third is not. Conscientious objection, plain conscientious objection, corresponds to a pacifist position. One who says war or the use of violence is always wrong will be a conscientious objector. Selective conscientious objection corresponds to the just war theory, which says some wars may be just. And the other side of that coin is, obviously, other wars are not just, and I cannot, with a clear conscience, participate in unjust wars. Incidentally, the first position is acknowledged and accepted by law. The second is not accepted in law for probably fairly obvious reasons, even though it's the dominant way of thinking about war in Christian tradition. A third view toward participation in war, of course, would be uncritical participation. And uncritical participation corresponds, I believe, to a form of idolatry, national idolatry. It says, my country, right or wrong, I will participate if I'm called upon. And that is not a Christian option. It is not a Christian option because it places the nation in the place of God. Finally, let me suggest that there are two developments in the modern period which have totally changed the meaning of war and our thinking about war. They're so drastic that they have thrown this whole just war theory into question, or at least they've made it difficult for it to operate. The first of these modern developments is the rise of nationalism. The rise of nationalism. The notion that one's highest loyalty belongs to one's nation is one of the most powerful and universal forces at work in the modern world. Other movements tend to be successful in proportion to their support for nationalism. Communism, for example, has been successful where it has been identified with the nationalistic aspirations of a people. Islam supports nationalism in Arab countries. Nationalism, which is the notion of a nation state consisting of people who speak the same language, is of very recent origin, and we often fail to recognize that. It's a phenomenon which is found really after the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars in the early 19th century. It destroyed the multinational states like the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The dynastic states in the period preceding the French Revolution were not really nationalistic in the modern sense. I mean, nationalism just wasn't a big deal back then. In the 18th century, for instance, the King of England couldn't speak English. He was a German of the House of Hanover. Frederick the Great of Prussia spoke and wrote in French. Charles V was King of Spain and Emperor of Germany, but he spoke French. The Swedish House of Bernadotte was started by a French general whom the Swedes decided would make them a good king. Nationalism was not a big deal. But today, nationalism is the most viable worldwide ideology, which supports religious and political movements insofar as they support nationalism. And the rise of nationalism has given modern warfare a very different sort of nationalistic tinge. Because of nationalism, now a whole people gets swept up into wars in ways which were just not the case previously. Wars are now fought with a devotion which makes them far more deadly than was formerly the case. Before the rise of nationalism, wars were often fought with mercenary soldiers who could, after all, have been drawn from any of the nations under the sun and who fought because they were paid to fight. That meant that often war was much more like a sport. I mean, they didn't fight when it got cold, for example. No self-respecting soldier would fight in the winter. And relatively few people were killed in those wars. That's a far cry from modern wars fought with a nationalistic fervor and involving whole populations in the effort. A second development, which has drastically changed the meaning of war in modern times, is of course the development of nuclear weapons. After Hiroshima and Nagasaki, war took on a far more threatening character. Most of us have some difficulty imagining what war was like before the French Revolution, when it was fought with professional soldiers who fought sort of according to definite rules like professional football players. The nationalistic wars of the last century or so we can imagine only too well. But the leap from that to nuclear warfare is one which most of us find difficult, if not possible, to imagine. How are we to think of the possibility of war in a nuclear age in the light of a just war theory, for instance? How can you talk about a reasonable hope of success in nuclear warfare when success means mutual suicide? How can you talk about inflicting proportionate damage to the injury received when you end up destroying everything? What happens is that the notion of total war has become obsolete in our generation. I said the other day, World War II is the last total war which this world will ever see until the final conflagration. So what emerges, or re-emerges rather, is the concept of a limited war. And in a limited war, you don't fight to win, but you fight to exercise power in a given situation. And that's very difficult, I think, for us, particularly as Americans, to understand. It means that wars in the future will probably be fought less for ideological reasons and more for economic reasons. It means that wars will probably once more be fought with paid soldiers rather than with drafted ones. Because in a limited war, you sort of need football players who will stop when the whistle's blown. And it means that war will be fought for more limited objectives. Well, then what about nuclear weapons in that kind of a situation? We continue to escalate our nuclear arsenal, and we refer to our nuclear deterrent on the theory that if we have nuclear weapons, we won't have to use them. But does the mere possession of nuclear weapons serve as a deterrent unless we also have the will to use them. And then if we have the will to use them, have we not defeated our very reason for having them, which was so that we would never have to use them? That's the kind of insane dilemma in which we find ourselves caught. And that's what makes modern warfare and the quest for disarmament and the search for peace such an ethical issue in our time. Now, how do we go about that? What are our resources as Christians? As Christians who affirm, first of all, the universality of the gospel and the Catholicity, the universality of the church, we can and must rise above idolatrous forms of nationalism. And our sense of the universality of the gospel and of the church ought to help us to do that. If the body of Christ is an international body, and if our highest allegiance is to Christ, then nationalism must always take second place. Whether as Christians we stand in the pacifist or in the just war tradition, we can, I think, agree on the immorality of nuclear war, and probably agree on the immorality of the threat to use nuclear weapons. But you see, that agreement really doesn't solve the problem for us. James Finn, I think, has stated well the challenge with which we're confronted today. He said, "For as long as humankind endures, it will live with nuclear weapons." If all that presently exists were to be destroyed, we would still have the knowledge of how to construct them. Since that is true, and since there is no reason to believe conflict will soon be rooted out of international affairs, we must accept our present uncertain and threatening time as an opportunity to create international structures that will inhibit large-scale wars. Those who believe that nuclear war is necessarily evil must work to see to it that it is made as unlikely as human affairs will allow. Well, I think that's the task to which all of us are called, to make as unlikely as possible the prospect of nuclear war. Well, what are some other things that we have in our arsenal? Personal, as it were. First of all, I think we need to think about a different understanding of security. When we talk about national security, we almost always do so strictly in military terms. And it could just be that we are blinded to what our genuine security must involve. Robert McNamara, whom you recognize as a former Secretary of Defense and President of the World Bank, said this in a speech in May of, I'm not sure when, I punched my right in the year number, so I don't remember, but it was a few years ago at the University of Chicago. He said this: "No nation can avoid the responsibility of providing an appropriate and reasonable level of defense for its society in an imperfect world. That is necessary. But what is just as necessary is to understand that the concept of security encompasses far more than military force, and that a society can reach a point at which additional military expenditure no longer provides additional security. Indeed," he continues, "to the extent that such expenditure severely reduces the resources available for other essential sectors and social services, and fuels a futile and reactive arm race, excessive military spending can erode security rather than enhance it." And he says, "In the matter of military force, as in many other matters in life, more is not necessarily better. beyond a prudent limit, more can turn out to be much worse. And finally, he says, we cannot build a secure world upon a foundation of human misery. Former President Dwight Eisenhower said something similar a number of years before when he said, every gun that is made, every warship that is launched, every rocket fired, signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, from those who are cold and are not clothed. We need to gain a wider sense, I think, of security as we carry on the discussion about nuclear weapons. Secondly, I think we need to consider more carefully and in a less reactive manner how we really understand the enemy. Jesus, of course, you know, said that we are called to love our enemies. That doesn't mean we must be blind to the dangers that are posed, but it does call upon us at least to take a broader look at what it is that we are responding to. And I came across this article recently by a fellow named Richard Barnett, who is head of the Institute, or connected at least with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. And he says some things that were a surprise to me. I hadn't quite thought of it in these terms before, and I share it with you. He talks about what the Soviets are doing in their own military buildup, and he says that they are in fact building to catch up with where we are. This if you look into the history of nuclear arsenal building, that has generally been the case, that we build something and then they build it and then it plateaus and then we get something and they... And he says the Soviets are building to catch up. And then he says every missile in the world, and this really struck me, every missile in the world not located inside the Soviet Union is aimed at the Soviet Union. Those of China, Britain, France, as well as the United States. Russia is the only country in the world surrounded by hostile communist powers. Hostile to Russia, that is. Communist powers hostile to Russia. Then later on he says, to be obsessed by the Soviet threat in a world in which more than 1 billion people starve, half the global workforce is projected to be without a minimally paying job by the year 2000, and industrial civilization is close to collapse because political paralysis and greed have kept us from solving the energy crisis, is quite literally to be blinded by hate. Billy Graham's courageous confession about how easy it is to confuse the kingdom of God with the American way of life ought to force all of us to realize how often we fall into the same trap. And he continues, every time we read a statement by a general or a senator or a president that we are prepared to threaten or launch a nuclear war in order to keep the Soviet leaders from doing something we don't like, a threat to recreate 100 Auschwitzes has been made in our name, but we are blind to it. If we do not have the clarity of moral vision to see that the Russian people cannot ever deserve 100 Auschwitzes, whatever their leaders do, then our faith rests not on reverence of God and his world, but on power fantasies and fear. And finally, he says, the choice is between love and hate. And hate is death. Hate demands an enemy. The identity hardly matters. Enemies change, but the spirit of enmity and fear remains. The big lie behind all murder, from the random street killing to the efficient ovens of Auschwitz to the even more efficient hydrogen bomb, is that the victims deserve to die. And Jesus said, love your enemies. Thirdly, finally, let me say that we are called to commitment in this whole realm. And here I would like to quote two brief passages. One from the summary of the U.S. Catholic Bishop's statement of a couple of years ago on War and Peace, their pastoral letter, where I think they say it very well. They say, the whole world must summon the moral courage and technical means to say no to nuclear conflict, no to weapons of mass destruction, no to an arms race which robs the poor and the vulnerable, and no to the moral danger of a nuclear age which places before humankind indefensible choices of constant terror or surrender. Peacemaking is not an optional commitment. It is a requirement of our faith. We are called to be peacemakers not by some movement of the moment, but by our Lord Jesus. The content and context of our peacemaking are set not by some political agenda or ideological program, but by the teaching of the Church. And to conclude, a part of a brief paragraph from our own statement, Mandate for Peacemaking, which incidentally I brought a number of copies along, and I realized just now that I left them in my room. I'll have them down here later in case some of you want to pick one up. Where the Church has said, the peacemaking task in our time requires a mass movement of social change. The building of a solid majority in our nations and other nations who will insist that national security be defined in less militaristic terms. The initial steps in that movement are taken in prayer, study, dialogue with others, and building a constituency for peace. That work is done not by political leaders alone, but by teachers, pastors, organizers, ethical leaders, prophets of the biblical tradition, and most especially by ordinary people who have a passion for peace. It begins with persons who have commitment. And I would hope that that includes all of us. Okay, so far my speech. Now, any comments, questions, concerns? Yeah.
Maybe more by way of a comment. You mentioned, well, I think it was a quote that you were reading when you talked about international structures and the giving up of your nationalism. Was there a suggestion there then that indicated that nations give up their sovereignty to declare war on one another into the hands of this international structure, or was that implied there, or?
I don't know what McNamara meant to imply, because that was just the passing reference that I read, and he didn't go on to talk about international structures at any greater length.
In some ways.
What do you think about that? What do you think about giving up some parts of sovereignty?
It seems to me that that would probably be the only possibility for ever bringing an end to global conflicts. I think we'll always have the little border skirmishes, but an international machine, if you wanted to call it that, could probably effectively squelch the border skirmishes too. I don't know. That's just, it was kind of a new thought for me, I guess, and it hit me in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey?
Well, we have so many border skirmishes. Look at what Russia has done in Afghanistan in the last few years. Look what Israel has done to connect all sorts of property in the last few years. What is our position on this? Yeah, those are the things that trouble me. The great big thing, the nuclear thing, if that comes, I just hope it falls on me because I don't want anyone.
Yeah.
I don't want to be around afterwards.
Yeah.
But these little things are moral issues, I think, for all of us to consider, because Are we to forgive Russia for going in and murdering a lot of Afghanistanis because they think they want that land? They have connected a whole lot of things, even as Israel has done. We tend to say, poor Israel, but they're just as guilty, I think, in connecting other lands and taking their position as Russia is, as Khomeini is now.
Let me raise a similar kind of question, which I think is current in terms of so much discussion. That's Central America today, where the critics of the current administration claim that the administration has really turned it into an ideological conflict between East and West. That's the critics who are saying that. I would have the question, is that even really the issue? Or, given the kind of understanding of war that at least I've described, is that merely a cover for economic issues which may lie closer to the heart of what our real interest is in some of those areas, which would speak, I think, also to the kinds of questions that you are raising about Israel, for instance, are there economic issues? Yes?
I feel that the economic issues have always been the underlying reason for war. And as the economy of the world has accelerated with the development of new ideas and new machines, so has the periods between wars accelerated. We used to have 100 years between a war, and now we have hardly any time to count the small confrontations that happen all over the world from time to time. So we are in a period of highly accelerated combat, one way or another, and we tend to put our focus on the big issues, the big enemies. Russia, United States, and our allies, and Russia, as you say, they're surrounded and they're threatened. And so we have many issues aside from the central one, but the central one is quite often, as you pointed out, an excuse to justify what I mean by the Central American soul. When they say the Russians are coming, so let's stop that. And it seemed to me, going back to your basic premise, of different kinds of wars and motivations for harm and needs, that now the focus is on how do we slow down or divert this controversy based on the ultimate weapon or types of weapons. And it seemed to me that if you cannot stop a man from having a weapon, which he can justify always in our society, maybe you can find some way of defusing that, not saying throw your weapons away, but put all of your nuclear weapons into storage, mothballs, if you will, so they can have them in case the ultimate disaster does approach them, but make them not readily available. And we have enough surveillance now to monitor this kind of a thing. But it would be a thing, a way of starting, rather than trying to break our picks on saying, you give up something, you destroy certain weapons, you destroy certain weapons, you don't do this, you don't do that. They say, okay, you keep what you have, we'll keep what we have, and we'll set them aside on some sort of agreeable basis.
Kind of a nuclear freeze.
They're not readily available. I don't know how this will work.
How about de-escalation?
Pardon?
De-escalation.
Well, the point of de-escalation is that you're asking someone to give away something they have that's now a defensive item. In other words, I have in my house a gun, which is a BB gun, which I use to drive cats away from getting my birds. I don't like the cats to feed the birds.
You like cats?
Okay. I don't like cats. Okay. So I mean, it's a small issue. But the point is that if you ask me to give up the birds or the gun or the cats, I'd say, well, okay, I'll let the birds fend for themselves and the cats do what they can, and I'll put the gun back in the closet and put the ammunition somewhere else where I can't really get it when I need it. And so I would set that aside gladly, just to defuse that issue between the cats and the birds. You know,
I think that
was the issue.
I think your point is perhaps to say we have to be realistic in terms of what's possible. You have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And you cannot start with kind of a total, let's say we're going to wipe everything out.
Yeah, we're not going to get
that's not going to happen.
Yeah, the Russians won't talk, and we won't talk except on certain conditions that they, you know. So we all find an excuse not to talk, or not to do anything. Tell me.
Ray, you?
Yeah, coming back to the first person, it's been the history of nations to try to establish international structures which would limit the exercise of human violence. The League of Nations, Geneva Convention, now the United Nations. And the issue has always been how much of our national rights are we able to give up and still feel secure? And that is probably, and as we get into nuclear reality, we see what it is. The whole world is going to move that way, realizing we've got to have some control of this. And they're going to have to give up what we've not been willing to give up. But the issue is in between the time when that happens and now. And we have managed to restrict the use of poisonous gas and biological warfare in a way that's amazing. Because all the countries, or a lot of them, have those very instruments already. And I think the nuclear freeze and then the defreeze are all working on that kind of a principle. Until we get the ideal where we're able to restrict ourselves by structures, can we not at least find a way to restrict, deny the use of something which is so horrible? And I think that we could probably all agree on, that it could be first declared illegal to ever use them. As we have said, it's illegal in the world, if you can speak that way, to use these other things. And then work at, you know, progress from that point. I think that would be a big step forward.
Or even to renounce first use of nuclear weapons.
I think we'll get a little more agreement quickly to say it's illegal for anybody ever to use them. I think we'll be...
Yeah, but it is, at least for me, it's instructive to remember that the Soviets have renounced first use of nuclear weapons, and we have not.
Yeah. It seems to me that the keywords in your speech, and I agree with them, war, peace, love, hate. And maybe the bottom line is, what are we choosing? As Christians, we ought to choose love. And I've often felt that I had made very small attempts to really take the gospel seriously. That love your neighbor, and that's certainly not just the man next door. We ought to think in global concerns. That is certainly Russia included. I haven't done that. That's a very scary thing. And I wonder how many of us would identify with that, really having done that. Maybe it's too naive and too simplistic. But along with it, I'd like to tie in some of your speeches on imagination and seeing visions and dreaming. Maybe we ought to dream of this society, of all being able to live together. We don't talk about that. And I think dreams are foreigners of things to come. Maybe we ought, as Christians, to dwell on that. I would like to. Maybe I'm single-minded. I don't know. Is that naive and simplistic?
Well, it's our vision of the future that often determines how we're going to act in the present, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And without some vision, without some assurance.
I think it's naive.
Yeah,
let's
hear it.
Okay. You think what is naive now?
Love the Russians, and they will love you back.
What it depends on what that means. What does loving the neighbor mean? Does it mean that you close your eyes to the threat that's posed? Is that what's implied in love?
Well, you can't close your eyes
to what the threat is.
To what the threat is.
Yeah.
If you can't do that, yeah. that would be naive, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But the question is whether loving means that you must close your eyes to the threat.
That's what we disagree on. When people say love, we're not sure whether they mean close your
eyes. That's right. That's right.
I think it means we must have concern about those people, and they have the same concerns about their lives as we have about ours. And if we are not concerned about the quality or about the work of their life, then we are not Christian.
There we go, I think. It means that we do not get caught in the trap of holy war thinking where we demonize the enemy. And we, I think, often fall into that trap. Even someone like the President of the United States, a year ago, spoke to a group of religious leaders in Florida, and he is reported to have said that the Soviet Union is the focus of evil in the modern world. Well, there is a certain sense, of course, in which you might say that kind of thing, but if you take that at what it says, it is demonizing the enemy. It's saying the enemy is the tool of Satan. He's not a creature of God. He's not one for whom Christ died. He is the focus of evil.
It's demonizing the nation of Russia, and I think that's where the fault comes in, because I think that some of their leaders are almost beyond the pale, but that doesn't mean that all of the people of Russia feel this way, and this is where I think they have been mistaken. We lumped them all into one package.
But we don't know some things. For example, we know a lot about love. We know a lot from our own knowledge, I'm speaking now. Not from what someone else has told me, not from what I read in a column or heard on the television. We know of our own knowledge about certain things. We have experience. Now, we all know our own knowledge of love, of neighbor. We've seen it. We've seen it applied and not applied. But it's not true about threat. We do not know of what we speak. The Russians are threatening us. The president did not know about the Russian people, whether they were demons or evil. He did not know about the Russian government. He doesn't even know the questions he should know about our government, our people.
Quotation from Barnett, and what he is saying is that there are communist nations surrounding Russia whom Russia regards as enemies, China being the most notable.
Well, yeah, but I thought that we were in that group too,
according
to them.
No. Back here, Dan.
I was thinking of two things. So often when we use the word we think of our primary identity as our nation. I think you mentioned that. Forget that as a baptized person, my first identity is that I am a member of another nation, which is a worldwide church. And so often I think we discuss things as Americans rather than what should the community of the church around the world do about the war. Because I think of my American citizenship very secondary to that citizenship in that new nation that's created by Christ. Secondly, sometimes we think of nonviolent love as weakness, while violent brute force is strength. And I think as a worldwide church, we've lost the sense of what I think Jesus taught his disciples in the Sermon on the Mount: the greatest power in this world is nonviolent love. know, and to ever call that naive is, makes me very uncomfortable, because I think Jesus was sending his disciples out into a very real world of violence with this form of power. And we've had hints of how that power can work, I think, in Gandhi and Martin Luther King. That, and they taught us that there's a power that we've lost, and if the whole Christian church on earth would be faithful to this power, who knows what, you know, could happen to this world. But we tend to believe what we have been taught, that military strength is more powerful.
There is an appeal in your position. I'd have to say in response, though, that I don't believe that a commitment to peace requires that one become a pacifist. I'm not a pacifist, for instance. I take it you are. I'm not. Yeah. I think that we can agree on the goal that we're after in a nuclear age, a kind of peace that we're after. Without necessarily agreeing on some pacifist position. That would be the only reservation that I would have.
Yeah, right. I'd share, from my point, I think the church needs a pacifist witness. And it would be a form of violence for me to say that every Christian should be like me.
Yeah.
I mean, that in itself would
yeah.
be.
Yeah. So that's an area where we're free to disagree on that.
But so often we come across when we talk as though we don't grant that distinction.
That's right.
And that hurts each other in the group.
That's
Everybody
right.
Everybody has a right to their own opinion, perhaps. He has a right to his opinion.
Well, let me say that not every opinion is possible within the Christian position.
Well,
it is not possible, for instance, I think, to grant to the nation an idolatrous position. That is simply antithetical to Christian faith. But one can take various views within.
Can I add just one thing to that? I think the justifiable war, when it says that war is a last resort, makes the assumption, when I called for the power of love, you know, if I was sounding like I was arrogantly telling everybody they need to be a pacifist, then I was wrong in my heart. But I think when a justifiable war position says war is the absolute last resort, it assumes that the normal way of life of every Christian in the world is pacifism, meaning nonviolent love. But then the justifiable war position says there may be a time when war may be the lesser of evils.
Exactly right. In fact, there was a section that I cut out of my presentation that would have said that the just war starts with the same presumption against violence as the pacifist does, but then comes to it only on the basis of a different reading of what love might require as a last resort.
So if I was making a passionate appeal, it was more for that, rather than to push a certain form of view.
I have to call a stop to this, because we're already a couple of minutes past time. Carry it on amongst yourselves.